Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello, I'm Scott Soshnick.
And I'm Evan Novy Williams, and this is the Americanization of Mexican Soccer Sports Business Podcast, The Sportacast.
Well, can't we say, Evan, I don't know why, I know we're going to talk about a Liga MX story, but at this point, with what's gone on with Todd Boehly and Chelsea, looks like British regulators have approved that deal and we're inching toward the finish line. Can't we say the Americanization of global soccer?
I think that's fair. Yeah, I would argue that the Americanization of global soccer has happened gradually over the past decade plus. There have been a handful of American Premier League owners for a long time now, a decade or more than that. But the Mexican soccer stuff, Scott, which you and I have talked a bit on the podcast in the past year or so, as of last year, I don't believe there was a single American investor that had ever bought into to Liga MX, the top tier professional league down in Mexico. Now we have one in Al Tilis and Sam Porter, and as you and I can discuss, another one, the owner of the San Antonio Spurs, Peter Holt, who is interested in looking at and is interested in buying another one. So I think there's between the Apollo deal that we talked about, or Apollo proposal that we talked about last week, it certainly seems as though there are a whole bunch of smart, interested, deep-pocketed people here in the U.S. that really want to do more investing into Mexican soccer.
All right, and let me go elsewhere as well. You know, you got the Glazers now. We see looking at an Indian soccer team. So global soccer, of course, the owners of Manchester United already. But what's it about? I mean, it's about eyeballs, right? You know, we look at the U.S., and I think the knee-jerk reaction is MLS would be the dominant league on television right now, or EPL on, you know, NBC and Saturday mornings. But the fact remains that nothing comes close to the Mexican Soccer League. When you deal Spanish language and English language, nothing comes close. So it is not surprising. I'm going to go way back to the John Skipper adage, give me the eyeballs, I'll figure out how to monetize. You're not tired of that one yet, are you?
I'm not. Absolutely.
Okay.
Not.
There were no David Stern stories today, so don't worry about it. We'll get to my focus group of one later. But for some reason, I don't know why. But given the eyeballs, given the demographic switches in the country, it is not a surprise that U.S. owners are finding, and particularly if we want to talk about Peter Holt, whose community is 60%+ Hispanic, it would make perfect sense that close to the border to own a team. And probably in your perfect world scenario, that they would move the team, actually have a Liga MX team, but move it to San Antonio. Mm. That would be the perfect world. I mean, they already have a soccer team
there
in the USL team, right? That plays friendlies against the Liga MX clubs. But the perfect world would be to buy the team, move it to San Antonio, operate it as a Liga MX team. But I just don't believe that Liga MX's other owners would allow that to happen.
Yeah, you just laid out, I think, very well the big part of the bullish case, for Liga MX is that it is extremely popular. There are changing demographics here in the U.S. and in specific places like San Antonio, where it is probably only going to grow more and more popular. There are some changes to the way Liga MX has been structured, including a temporary, maybe permanent suspension of relegation and promotion, which, as we've seen with Major League Soccer, really helps inflate the value of clubs when there's no risk that after a bad season, you could be playing in a completely different
league.
Did you see
the celebration at Aston Villa?
I did see the celebration. I mean, I saw the celebrations across the Premier League.
Mid-game, everybody storms the field because they're so happy that they were clear of relegation. They're not being sent down. I'm not kidding you. Unless it was two teams playing for the championship, like they're tied or 1 point separates, playing for the championship, I would rather watch a save relegation game than a top 6-7 EPL team playing for third place or second place. It's so much fun.
But would you rather own a second to last place team that couldn't get kicked out, or a second to last place team that had to win to stay up?
It's very funny. For a couple of the U.S. investors who have purchased EPL teams, I have kind of on a week-to-week basis sort of checked in, you know, and really there's this level of insanity of, you know, on the schedule, you can look at games you should not win, you know, on paper, games you should win, and then those toss-up points, right? And anytime those owners or their teams get a point, salvage a point, or I mean, imagine get 3 points from a game they were not supposed to get anything from, oh my Lord, the euphoria that exists, because you get one or two of those, and then the status quo the rest of the game, you might be 4 or 5 points clear of relegation without having to have the weekly palpitations at the end of the year, right? And that's how it goes. I mean, it's not just you want to win. The difference in the ability to generate revenue from staying up in the EPL, going down to the first division, that's significant. And boy, it certainly affects what folks will pay for the franchises.
So Liga MX investors are now at least protected from that downside risk for at least the next few years, and maybe a lot moving forward. There are, they say, a commitment to new transparency in a way that didn't exist before. All of those things, Scott, we can kind of wrap into, this is the bullish case for Liga MX. The bearish case is that it's still not all that transparent, that the teams don't get along all that well. Right now, as we talked about a few weeks ago with the Apollo thing, all the clubs sell their own commercial rights in the U.S. and domestically. So there are a few teams making a lot of money and a lot of other teams who maybe aren't very popular outside of their own state or outside of their own city, which do not get to share in the popularity of the league as a whole. There's a lot of these things, and we have to mention it because it's also relevant here, fan violence. There have been a series of pretty bad events in Mexican soccer stadiums over the past few years, certainly the most ugly of which happened this March. The team, Querétaro, that Peter Holt is interested in has to be sold because they were hosting the match in March where there was that really, really bad incident where dozens of people were hurt and more than a dozen people were arrested afterwards. And the league essentially said, look, these owners can't be associated with this league anymore. It's now being controlled by a previous owner who has until the end of the year to sell it. So this is a forced sale and not the kind of forced sale that you want to see. So while we're talking about all the bullish aspects of the league, it's important, I think, to note that the team that we know that is for sale because of some of the things that have deterred, I think, a lot of overseas investors in Liga MX in the past.
Now, do you think there's a torn emotional part with some of the Liga MX owners versus, we know there are some Mexican-based bid groups for the team, and now here comes Peter Holt, and he's doing it as individual, and RC Buford, of course, an executive with Spurs Sports and Entertainment, also in on the bid group. But this is not SSE. This is Peter Holt individual and group. Now, there's got to be sort of a, well, we'd like to keep it as sort of, you know, the Mexican, the idea of Mexico, the DNA of Mexico. However, there sure is a lot of money, know-how, synergies, things we can utilize from SSE, or at least from the people involved there. Your thoughts on where they are?
Yeah, I think I'm sure there is a group of people that would prefer Liga MX teams to all stay in the hands of Mexican investors. On the other hand there, Scott, the Liga MX has been in talks with MLS for a while about a lot of different potential business tie-ups. They talked about a merger for a while. I think that's unlikely, but they're doing more things together in a lot of ways. I think there's a group of people within Liga MX that understand that the clearest path towards a lot of commercial growth for their league is really to embrace the idea of North American club soccer in its entirety. And whether that means playing more friendlies against MLS clubs, maybe it's diving deeper into this midseason tournament that they just announced last week.
Well, I don't want to gloss over that. That's a big deal. I mean, think when you're selling TV rights to create an entirely new property that lives outside sort of broadcast contract proper, saying, all right, what else? You know, this is an add-on. What else? That's going to drive not only a tremendous amount of interest and fuel a little bit more of that. These two entities should get together as one. But you know, it's going to fuel a lot of interest when it comes time to bid for it. Who wants to show this thing?
Without question.
Valuable property.
Yeah, for sure. So this idea that you mentioned at the beginning there that Peter Holt, if he were to buy this team, would probably prefer it to play in San Antonio. A Liga MX team that's based in the U.S. would automatically become the most valuable club in Liga MX, right? So there is obviously a tremendous amount of commercial opportunity here in the U.S. that probably comes maybe with a little bit less of the downside concern that might exist in Mexico right now. So yes, I think there's probably, you'd get both. I think you get some owners in Liga MX that would rather see it all stay within Mexico. And I think you get some owners in Liga MX who understand that maybe allowing more international investors, maybe working more closely with MLS and working more closely with America as a whole, is an opportunity to make a lot more money off the asset that you hold back in Mexico.
All right. You gave me a great segue. You said make a whole lot more money. We're talking about Peter Holt, who owns an NBA team. So I can now make that transformation. We heard our all NBA teams were recently announced, and the big winner, according to our Lev Akabas, is Trae Young. And do we still want media members determining who makes 35 million and more and up? I've always wondered, like, we never in our careers at the outlets where we've been working, we have always abstained from voting for things like MVP. And this is precisely why I don't want to have a say as a journalist into who makes more money. That's just not our role. And I'm surprised that folks still do it. But Trae Young, the big winner this time around.
Yeah, I think this is we talk about this, I think, every year. It's fascinating that a media vote like this, which is the top three all NBA teams, can so directly impact a player's salary. And we don't have to get into all the details, but essentially,
well, it's written into the CBA.
It's in the CBA. Yeah. If you make a all NBA team, if you then re-sign a contract, the max payday you can get from your team is vastly different depending on whether you've met that criteria or not. And you're right. I think there's two problems here. One, and Draymond Green has been very outspoken about this, I think, and I'm quoting here at one point recently, he called it absolutely disgusting that media voting can swing, and we're talking about tens of millions of dollars here, can swing tens of millions of dollars into or out of a player's pocket just because of that voting. And Scott, you flicked at it as well. I think there's also a journalism ethics question here too, that journalists who routinely cover the NBA and cover its players should not be participating in votes that this directly affect those players' economic earning potential. And to put a bow on this, just because I think it's a good example, Lev wrote in his story about Jason Tatum, who 2 years ago, Jason Tatum signed a 5-year, $163 million extension with the Celtics. If he had been picked for an all NBA team right before that, which I'm sure he was at least in consideration for, that $163 million contract could have been a $196 million contract. We're talking about $30 million plus swings here in what athletes, NBA athletes, can sign for, just whether or not they made the team. And to make this even more insane, Tatum the year before secured more ballot votes than Kyrie Irving, who made the third team as a guard, but he was classified as a forward and missed the cut at that position. So not only did Tatum miss out on this, he got the requisite amount of votes, but because of debate over whether Kyrie Irving and he were guards or forwards, made this even more complex and he lost out on it. It's so silly that this can hang not only on media votes, but also a debate about who plays what position. I'm shocked that this still exists, and I think it should change ASAP.
All right, so we have what this boils down to is a controversy of nomenclature in the positioning.
Among many things, yeah.
Yeah, but also, by the way, this whole thing was dubbed the Derrick Rose rule. Mm. I mean, it was a way for you to keep your player even if you couldn't afford to pay him as much as he was probably worth. And then in like the fifth year of the contract, if he hit certain milestones, then you could give him this kicker. And that was one of them. But there's a danger in the nomenclature as well. You're too young to remember this, but do you remember what it was called for a player who had a big contract? And if you wanted to waive him and not have to pay the luxury tax, do you remember what that was named
man.
For?
I don't remember.
I'm giving you a little NBA trivia here. We're going memory lane.
Is it Detlef Schrempf?
No. Nobody would have. Come on. Who wants to get rid of Detlef Schrempf? No. My Lord. No. It was called the Allen Houston rule.
Okay. Yeah.
And then something very fascinating. So the whole thing, like you're going through all this, the Allen Houston rule. And you know the best part of it? When push came to shove, the Knicks did not waive Allen Houston.
Oh, that's funny.
So, you know, it became known as the Allen Houston rule and he stayed. So,
yeah, I'm obviously all for rewarding players who are playing well and at the top of this very elite profession. And I'm all for making it easier for teams to re-sign players in that scenario, as opposed to ones who want to leave in free agency. I think all of those things are obviously great things. I think tying this all up into this being the metric and this being the very silly and non-uniform voting. If you talk to some of the journalists who vote here, it's not even as if they have a firm understanding of what criteria they should be using. I think all of this needs a refreshing because, again, it's for a number of different ways you can look at it. I think it's problematic.
All right, I'm going to push a segue here. You said refreshing. I'm going to push that to refreshing.
Nice.
That brings me to a cold Pepsi. I prefer Diet Pepsi, as you know. Well, actually, I prefer Diet Dr. Pepper. But Pepsi is officially, and we've known this is coming, but as coming out of the NFL owners' meetings, one thing we found out, that Pepsi renewed its deal with the NFL, its sponsorship. But the one piece, probably the highest profile piece, that they will not renew is their sponsorship of the Super Bowl halftime show. And we did a story a while back on sort of the little community that is the halftime show and what it's worth and why. So Pepsi out, who in? We know the NFL wants to probably 3x what it gets for that event. The NFL, again, it never ceases to amaze. Pepsi says this is part of sort of a bigger strategy, a little shift in strategy far beyond just the Super Bowl halftime show. But you and I think will agree that there will be no shortage of suitors to get that isolated time when, once again, so many eyeballs are focused on the product.
I think you and I would agree, Scott. This just boils down to economics. I'm sure Pepsi would love to have this right at the price that they were paying. And from what I understand, the NFL is asking for 2.5 to 3 times what Pepsi's paying. And it seems like Pepsi
is paying for a commercial these days. What am I paying? $6 million, right?
For a halftime, 30, for 30, a Super no, Bowl 30-second ad. Yeah, yeah. It's $6 to $7 million, I think. Yeah.
All right, so let's extrapolate. How long is halftime show? Where your branding is seen, where people will be talking about it.
It's an 18-minute show, plus you get a lot of the shoulder.
Is it a better buy to do the halftime show than just take your 30-second ad?
I'm sure that's exactly the debate that's happening in the marketing department of a lot of
both existing NFL partners
and not.
Could you do that? Could you put up a QR code for 18 minutes and have the most successful halftime show ever?
It's a good question. I can't remember during the show how much Pepsi is allowed to, what they're allowed to do on screen at the time. It's very easy, I think, to argue that the Pepsi halftime or the halftime show at the Super Bowl is one of the biggest events of the year in music, right? It's getting a massive roughly 100 million person audience, maybe a little bit less than that at this point, or maybe a little bit more. I can't remember the most recent numbers, but it certainly is probably the most watched live concert in the US, at least. There's a lot of different ways to slice this, and I'm sure the NFL has all this in the pitch deck, ways to slice this at this being a really valuable property. At the same time, the NFL is trying to raise the price of it 3x, right? And is it that different than what it was 3 or 4 years ago? Who knows? So I'm very fascinated to see where this nets out, if this ends up with a company that's already in a relationship with the NFL, if there's
you
somebody
else. You and I disagree on this one. You're almost certain that it's going to be some company with an existing relationship with the NFL.
That would have been my expectation. And that's essentially how Pepsi kind of came into it after Bridgestone. It just seems like there's enough other synergies in there. And obviously there's a lot of companies that work with the NFL that are very happy with it and would like to do more. And you can always pay more to the NFL, but it's not all that often that there's just a whole new big high profile sponsorship opportunity for your company with the NFL. That doesn't come around all that much. And this is a nice high glossy glitzy one. So yes, my gut would tell me that this is probably going to be an NFL partner, but we can see when this deal finally gets done, what it looks like and also what the price is, right? Is this a $60 million a year property? Maybe it is. And if that's true, that's great for the NFL, right? To sell a sponsorship to an 18-minute segment of your one game and get that kind of money, that's great.
Speaking of glossy and glitzy, since you utilize that terminology, that allows me to bring in Taylor Swift. And okay, we have a tie-in. Did you see Taylor Swift did the... Well, first of all, she had a relationship with Coke, so she never was going to do the halftime show.
Okay, that's interesting.
So now you're open to Taylor Swift, right? You're talking about global superstars. Maybe we call Taylor and say, hey, how about a little halftime show? But she was the commencement speaker at NYU. I don't know if you knew that here in New York.
I did not know that.
And one of those in the purple cap and gown, Mr. Peter Schwartz, formerly of Sportico, doing a great valuation. So
look at that.
Just want to give a little congratulations to Peter Schwartz, who sat there and listened to Taylor's the commencement speech at Yankee Stadium. By the way, for those of you, I mean, go follow Peter on Twitter. If you don't know Peter, Canadian, like knows every Blue Jay trivia thing in the world, but absolutely loves the New York Yankees. And I mean, you couldn't script this any better. So a Yankee Stadium commencement for his JD, by the way, for his law school degree. And where was he sitting? Where was he sitting in Yankee Stadium? Because it's Peter Schwartz.
Oh my gosh. I was going to say right behind the visitor's dugout.
No, he was in the judge's chamber.
Oh, that's great.
Law school, judge's chamber, Peter Schwartz. It's that makes absolutely sense. Perfect. All right. I went on a little tangent there, allowed.
It's all good. I've got a few more NFL things.
Give me some other NFL tidbits.
There were some owners meetings in Atlanta last week. And among the things that they decided on, voted on, a change in the ownership rules, Scott. I think this is interesting. I think you do as well. The NFL is essentially making it easier for longtime owners who have owned teams for 10 plus years, to hand these teams down to their children or to their to other people in their family. I think this is, again, just another example of the way in which kind of the changing economics of teams as they get so much more expensive than they were when they were purchased, the way in which the league is slightly changing its rules to make it easier for them to stay in the family.
Yeah, I would say the leading reason for change of control ownership of these franchises would be estate planning. Mm-hmm. And if the NFL can in some way make it easier for a controlling owner getting up there in years to keep it in the family some way, while maybe somehow getting some more liquidity, you could see them wanting to do that. You and I are expecting to see changes in the NFL ownership rules moving forward. Like it was changed once, but right now, you got the Bills that sold for like 1.4, I believe it was. Then you had David Tepper's purchase of the Panthers, 2.something, right?
2.3, I believe.
2.3, all right, almost. I'm not going to say doubling, but almost doubling. It depends on the time frame. So you got 2.3. Now you're looking at the Denver Broncos, and I think we all expect that to be in the 4.5, maybe even starting with a 5 in front of it, doubling. The question is, 4 years from now, 3 years from now, whatever it is, will the next team be sold for 9.5, 10? And if so, there are certainly a finite number of people, as there are right now. You know, I spent some time recently with Rob Walton, a very, very interesting guy. And, you know, he's among the bidders, and Josh Harris among the bidders. There just aren't that many folks who can come in and write the check. And if this thing, you know, these assets balloon to $9, $10 billion price tags, the NFL will certainly have to look at either taking private equity, which I don't think they're going to do. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's enough support for that. And frankly, if they ever need an injection of capital, they could just sit around their own table and say, folks, let's do it internally, right? Why go outside?
Agreed.
But they'll have to make it easier for people to come in and buy these franchises.
And just to do the specifics real quick of what this change means, when you buy right now, if you buy an NFL team, the controlling owner has to own 30% of the team. Over time, if you own the team long enough, that number used to go down to 5%. So you could, if you'd owned the team for 20 years, as you as the controlling owner, you could have 5%. The rest of your original 30% plus stake could be held by all of your children. The NFL is lowering that 5% limit to 1%. So essentially, if you think about the way that estate tax works, they're lowering the potential estate tax of handing this team down 80% in this process. So a slight change that actually, when you're talking about these values that you're talking about, Scott, these multi-billion dollar valuations, actually could save owners a lot of money. And if you look at the ownership of the NFL, it's turned over a little bit, as you said, but there's a whole lot of people who have owned these teams for a very long time. They're getting up there in age. I'm sure a lot of them are starting to think about their estate planning. What happens when I die, or what happens if I'm not able to or want to control this team anymore? I'm sure estate planning is top of mind for a lot of owners across sports, but particularly right now in the NFL.
All right, one headline nugget that also came out of that meeting was Commissioner Roger Goodell saying maybe we'll do away with the Pro Bowl. Even though you get 7 million plus viewers, you know, it's just, I don't understand. You can play the All-Star game in the NBA. You go half energy for most of it. And then you try and win at the end. Right. In the NFL, you can't go full bore. Just who wants to get hurt in an All-Star game? And people do anyway. So what do you do? What's the dilemma here? You have a game that isn't all that compelling, and yet 7 million people, which is like a really good NBA playoff number, right? 7 million people still tune in. So what do you do?
It's such an interesting paradox. I wonder if there's any other annual telecast in America that the ratio of amount of people watching is so high, but also the amount of people that if you ask them would tell you that the product kind of sucks. I think it's so interesting to me that the Pro Bowl, I don't think I know a single person who watches the Pro Bowl and thinks it is a compelling piece of television, but I know so many people who watch it. And that to me is the crazy paradox here for the NFL is that a broadcast that gets 7 million viewers, and that's on the low end. That was an all-time low, I think, or a all-time recent low for the NFL last year.
It is wonderful to have addicted customers.
Yeah, there are sports leagues that would kill to have a meaningless exhibition game that draws 7 million viewers.
Forget a meaningless
viewers.
Exhibition, they'd kill to have a championship game that drew 7
exactly.
million.
Exactly, and yet everybody around the NFL and most of its fans also, I think, accept that this is a bad product that has gotten worse by the fact that players and executives are obviously afraid of people getting hurt, about the potential consequences of playing the game hard. And football, as you said, is not a sport that you can play it at 50%. It seems like such a funny, interesting little media paradox that there was obviously a very valuable property that is clearly also not working.
Well, I hope you spoke to our colleague Aslep Elite a little bit closer than I did, because she told us we talk about pickleball. They were down ringing the bell, you know, the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
But she came back talking pickleball. I'm going to exhaust all of my pickleball knowledge here and then let you finish it up.
Okay.
I know Mark Lasserie, the part owner of the Milwaukee Bucks, somewhat reluctantly, begrudgingly bought a franchise. I know Gary Vaynerchuk has a franchise. I know it's getting very popular. And I actually witnessed my first pickleball, match. I saw, should we name who was on the court?
Yeah, give me some names.
I saw three. I'm trying to think who the other, but it was Harvey Schiller, I believe, was playing with David Blitzer, and Mark Locke, the CEO of Genius Sports, was on the other side, taking it very seriously, by the way.
Whoa, this is a high power.
Yeah, I would not be surprised. I don't know this for sure.
I thought you were going to be like, my neighbor Bob.
No. I would not be surprised, Angela. If like Mark brought his own pickleball racket and, like, you know, unwrapped it and was ready to go with it. You know, he was taking it very seriously. But, you know, I seems like a lot of fun catching on. I hear more and more. I know it's going to cost me, what, $500,000, right? Half a mil to buy a franchise now. What more do I need to know?
Yeah, you're going to see more and more pickleball in the coming weeks and years. It is one of these sports that is at this interesting nexus where, from a participation standpoint, it is skyrocketing. It was once a sport that was very popular just kind of among elderly folks in warm weather communities who maybe used to play tennis, used to play racquetball, and were looking for a lower impact thing. Those barriers have kind of broken down now. There's tons of people of all ages that are playing it. Scott, I've played it a number of times. It is extremely fun. From a participation standpoint, pickleball, I think the sky is the limit in some ways for them. What that means for professional leagues, for TV contracts, things like that, who knows? So I would be very bullish on pickleball that's continuing to loop in and grab market share from sports like tennis or sports like ping pong or shuffleboard. All those things get compared.
See, you're still in good shape. You do your Ironmans and stuff. You can still do the tennis and the whatever. My demo, like, you need the smaller move less, but it is a lot of like darting left and right. Like, I would fear the Achilles and the torn calves. As you know, I've had that in the past. See, that's my fear, that this requires sharp, quick movements, which does not lend itself well to the Soshnik athleticism these days.
Yes, I think that there's obviously a concern of that. The thing that pickleball has done really well is that people that are at vastly different skill levels can play against each other and have a good time. I've played with my mother before. I won't say how old she is. I almost did that. She would have killed me.
Let me guess one thing about your mother. One thing, former Broadway actress. One thing, she does not want to lose.
Yes, she's very competitive. And we have fun when we're playing against each other. If my mom and I were to go out to a tennis court and try to play together, it would be the most excruciating experience for me, just because the sport just doesn't lend itself that way. Pickleball is one of those sports where people have very different physical abilities, people have very different intensity levels, people have very different hand-eye coordination levels, can excel and have fun on the court against each other. I think that's one of the reasons why, from a participation standpoint, it has a lot of green grass ahead of it. But again, there's some smart people. Tom Dundon, the owner of the Carolina Hurricanes, has invested. You mentioned Mark Lazary in there. A lot of very smart people are buying up professional franchises or trying to invest in governing bodies. I'm sure there will be an Olympics pickleball push at some point in the next half decade or so. All of those things sound great. It's just a question of whether interest in playing the sport translates in any way to interest in watching people who are much better than you play it either live or on television.
Shout out to Nita Novi. Her son can be found on Twitter at Novi_Williams.
Hi, Mom.
I am Scott Soshnick. You can find me on Twitter at Soshnick. Our digital media editor is Core Veltman. She loves it when I remind you that the show can be found at Sportacast, which is the hub of what will soon become the Sportico Media Network.